Radio Prague News.
Czech President Václav Klaus has set a condition for signing the Lisbon Treaty, apparently involving an exemption from the Charter of Fundamental Rights. A Polish newspaper has cited an unnamed source according to which the president's condition involves the Beneš decrees, and the Czech interim government will not have to seek a vote of confidence and will present its policy plan at the next session of parliament. Czech President Václav Klaus has come up with a new condition for signing the EU-reforming Lisbon Treaty. Swedish Prime Minister Fredrik Reinfeldt told the news agency Reuters on Thursday that President Klaus wants a footnote added to the treaty. Neither the Czech president nor Prague Castle has issued any further clarification. However, the head of the EU Parliament, Jerzy Buzek, said after meeting the Czech head of state on Friday that the president wants an opt-out on the treaty's appended Charter of Fundamental Rights. President Klaus, for his part, has said he will only explain his demand once the ongoing constitutional review involving Lisbon is complete. The Eurosceptic Czech president, along with his Polish counterpart, have still not signed the reform treaty, which was expected to come into force at the beginning of 2010. Klaus is likely to be the last European head of state to do so after Polish President Lech Kaczynski said he would sign the treaty this Saturday. The Czech president is now waiting for the Constitutional Court to give its verdict on a new complaint about Lisbon lodged by a group of right-wing senators. The Polish daily Rzeczpospolita on Friday cited an unnamed source close to Mr. Klaus, according to which the president's desired footnotes to the Lisbon Treaty involve the so-called Beneš decrees. The paper's Prague source says that the president's concern centers on the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights, which he believes could give rise to property disputes with Sudeten Germans and their adjudication by foreign judges with no knowledge of the history of the region. The paper holds that Mr. Klaus is looking for a guarantee that would subordinate the charter to Czech law, as the UK and Poland have received. The Beneš decrees formed the legal grounds for the displacement of the native German population from Czechoslovakia in the aftermath of World War II. The two main Czech political parties, the Social Democratic Party and the Civic Democratic Party, have announced that the country's ruling interim government will not have to ask for a confidence vote in parliament, effectively prolonging the technocratic caretaker administration until elections. Speaking after a meeting on his mandate with the main party leaders on Friday, Prime Minister Jan Fischer said he would be submitting his policy program to the next session of parliament, including his cabinet's priorities and plans for the remainder of its term. Now turning briefly to the weather, currently partly sunny conditions are forecast to turn rainy for the weekend, with highs of 15 degrees Celsius. I'm Christian Falvey, and that's the end of the news.
Hello, you're tuned to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio, with me, Rosie Johnston. Coming up in the show today, Czech President Václav Klaus lays down his conditions for signing Lisbon, the Czech Republic's crumbling D1 motorway is finally going to get a facelift, and bankers' crusades to improve the image of the Czech Republic in this week's business news. Then later, we talk to Simon Maurer, a British author who's been creating a stir with his latest novel about a modernist Czech villa.
What I wanted was to feel the house. I wanted to put myself imaginatively in the place of somebody who had it designed and built and lived in it.
All that's coming up in the show today, so stay tuned. Eurosceptic President Václav Klaus on Thursday threw another spanner in the works of the Lisbon Treaty. During a telephone conversation with Swedish Prime Minister Fredrik Reinfeldt, whose country currently presides over the EU, the Czech president said that he would only sign the Lisbon Treaty on two conditions: if the Czech Constitutional Court rejected a legal challenge to it, and if the EU was prepared to add a footnote to the treaty pertaining to the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights. Daniela Lazareva has been following the story and joins me now in the studio. So, Daniela, first of all, what exactly is the Czech president after? How is this new demand being interpreted?
Well, Rosie, I have to say that this latest demand has come as a major surprise, not just to EU officials, but to politicians here in the Czech Republic. So at this point, nobody is quite sure how to interpret it. And it's all just another sign of how unpredictable Czech politics is, particularly how unpredictable President Václav Klaus is, who very often acts as a lone player. The head of the European Parliament, Jerzy Buzek, is in Prague today, and he's been holding intensive consultations both with the Czech Prime Minister, with Mr. Fischer, and President Klaus to ascertain what this is all about and how big a hurdle this latest demand is, whether it seriously threatens the treaty's ratification.
So what is it exactly that President Václav Klaus wants?
Well, following talks with Mr. Klaus, Mr. Buzek confirmed that the Czech president actually wanted an opt-out on the Charter of Fundamental Rights that's attached to the Lisbon Treaty, meaning that he wants an exemption of application of some rights. Now, there has been speculation in the Polish media that it could be linked to the post-war Sudeten-German expulsions, that the president fears the treaty could open the door to property disputes with Sudeten-Germans. Now, that's not been confirmed because Mr. Klaus himself won't say what the opt-out is about. However, if it was something of that kind, it would mean that the appendix or the footnote would have to be approved over again by the 27 member states. In any case, the Czech president is not actually in a position to ask for such a change himself. It would have to be the Czech government, specifically the prime minister, who would have to do that. And Mr. Buzek has basically asked the Czechs to sort this out between them. He's asked them to decide whether they want to ask for an opt-out or not before the EU has anything to say about it.
So what would the chances of Prime Minister Jan Fischer's government asking for this opt-out actually be? I mean, after all, the treaty has been approved by both houses of the Czech Parliament already.
That's true, and it's hard to say what the caretaker Prime Minister will now do. This is certainly not an easy decision for him. There are 500 million people waiting for the Czech Republic to ratify this treaty, and officials in Brussels are getting impatient. Some are already calling for Plan B. Mr. Fischer told reporters today that he would analyse the matter and take a stand in due course, possibly when he knows all the details. Either way, the Czech Republic has a very big problem, not just the EU, but the Czech Republic. Some legal experts say the president is overstepping his powers in this matter, so obviously pressure will be exerted on President Klaus here at home to sign. If he doesn't, Czech politicians could start impeachment proceedings against him, and indeed the Green Party is already calling for that. Or Parliament could vote him unfit for office, which would create internal chaos here in the Czech Republic. If the Prime Minister, on the other hand, does ask for the opt-out, there would most likely be a long delay. Brussels would doubtless come up with Plan B, and the Czech Republic would have damaged its reputation in the EU beyond repair. So at present, it just seems to be a lose-lose situation for the Czechs.
Well, this all sounds very confusing and unfortunate indeed. Daniela Lazareva, thank you very much, and we'll be sure to keep you up to date with all of the twists and turns that there are bound to be in this story as it develops. Now, the Transport Ministry has announced extensive plans to overhaul more than 160 kilometres of what's often considered to be the country's worst highway, the busy D1 motorway from Prague to Brno. For years, the D1 has been plagued by ageing surfaces, damaged sections and complicated reconstruction, often a nightmare for drivers. But transport officials hope that all that could be about to change. Jan Willinger has the details.
If you ask anyone about the Czech Republic's oldest highway, the D1, don't expect to hear many positive answers. We spoke to a number of people on Prague streets on Friday, and here's what they had to say about the country's D1 highway.
I studied 8 years in Olomouc, so I use this way every month, twice or three times, and it's really horrible. Really, it's good to renovate it.
It's a miserable highway. The quality of surface is just awful. When you drive there, it's not driving. It's war.
I think the best thing would be if a foreign company won the tender. Best of all would be one from Germany. Look at their highways compared to ours. Theirs are real quality. Germany or Austria, when you cross the border, the difference is obvious.
Increasing quality and safety is something the Transport Ministry and the Road and Motorway Directorate of the Czech Republic are addressing in the most extensive reconstruction planned in the highway's long history. On Thursday, the spokeswoman for the Road and Motorway Directorate, Martina Vápiňková, told public broadcaster Czech TV that the estimated cost for the project would be 18 billion crowns, the equivalent of roughly 1 billion U.S. dollars. Beginning next year, reconstruction will first cover the most damaged and worn sections of the highway, then move to different areas, eventually all the way from Mirošovice near Prague to Kivalka near Brno. The Road and Motorway Directorate, Martina Vápiňková.
Předpoklad opravy všech těch úseků je do 10 let. Bychom chtěli tu dálnici jako krok první.
We expect that the project could be completed over 10 years. The first step will be to widen the highway by roughly 1 meter on each side. That will mean that whenever any surface renovation takes place, we will always be able to keep 2 traffic lanes open in both directions.
Konstrukci povrchu té dálnice vždy zachovat průjezdnost 2 plus 2 jízdní pruhy.
The cost of revamping the D1 may seem high, not least during a period of economic crisis, but a transport ministry official said on Thursday that the ministry had already allotted some 800 million for 2010. Also, it is expected that additional funds could come from both the state and private sectors under existing programs. Of course, the 18 billion is just an initial figure. Over 10 years, it is possible the final price tag will still go up.
Jan Wellinger with that report. Now, what's been happening in Czech commerce this week? For this week's business news, I'm joined in the studio by Chris Johnstone, a man with all the answers.
Czech Finance Minister Eduard Janota is a man who seems unable to take a break. Hard on the heels of pushing the 2010 budget past reluctant politicians, he has raised the prospect of another, rather unappetizing package for them to digest. Mr. Janota is now calling for a follow-up 2011 budget to be thrashed out. He says a combination of more progressive, read higher direct taxation and value-added tax, and further round of spending cuts should curb the budget deficit below next year's target of 163 billion crowns. While some parties say the 2011 budget should be worked out by the caretaker government, others point out that there are thin chances of getting such measures agreed before elections in the middle of the year.
Meanwhile, the Czech Central Bank is leading a campaign to correct Western media coverage of the region. At the height of the financial crisis, the Central Bank was outspoken in its attacks on the tendency to lump all Central and Eastern European countries in the same bag for their perceived risks of ballooning state debt and private banking sector collapse. This week, Czech Deputy Governor Miroslav Singer filed off an angry reprimand to the Financial Times, pointing out that the mostly foreign-owned Czech banks are providing cash to other banks in their financial groups rather than taking it. And the Wall Street Journal revealed how Mr. Singer now has the habit of displaying a graph whenever possible, pointing out how the banking sector in major West European countries is in a far worse mess than this region.
There has been more bad news on the jobs front. The famous truck maker Tatra has announced that it will lay off 550 workers, around a fifth of its total workforce, by the end of the month because of a slump in orders. Tatra expects its turnover this year to be down 40% compared with last. There have also been signals from French parent company Alstom Power that jobs at its Brno turbine plant are in danger. The Brno plant employs 650. Figures released this week show that Czech unemployment climbed to 8.6% in September, with more than 500,000 now looking for work.
The landlocked Czech Republic is set to be the central European embarkation point for the famous US beach-style restaurant Hooters. A local businessman has done a deal with the American parent company to open franchises in the Czech Republic and Slovakia. The appropriately named Hooters is famous for its well-proportioned and outgoing waitresses who play a key role in the success of the restaurant chain, cited in almost all big US towns and cities. The Czech businessman who landed the franchise points to the concept's success in Germany, where they're now experiencing a boom.
And finally, the European Commission this week cleared an almost 10-year-old deal over the ownership of Prague heating company Praská teplárenská. It's not that things move slowly in Brussels, but the company's owners belatedly realised they had not got clearance from competition watchdogs when the deal first came into effect and moved to tidy up the situation. But the move wrong-footed a lot of local media, which saw the deal as something new rather than confirmation of the status quo.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Radio Prague, broadcasting from the heart of the Czech capital. Now, just before this week's Arts, with British novelist Simon Moore talking to us about his latest Brno-based book, here's a bit of news that might be of interest to listeners.
Now hundreds of thousands of Czechoslovaks.
November 17th of 1989 set in motion the Velvet Revolution, which led to the peaceful overthrow of the communist regime in Czechoslovakia. Following a brutal police crackdown on an unarmed student demonstration in Prague on that day, thousands of people took to the streets, asserting their desire for change.
Chanted the names of Dubček and Havel in when thousands of Czechoslovaks.
Do you recall the mass protests in the streets of Prague and the election of dissident playwright Václav Havel, the country's first post-communist president? On the 20th anniversary of the fall of communism, Radio Prague is asking its listeners the world over to share their memories of those heady days. Write and let us know where and how you heard the news and how you were affected by it. Radio Prague will select the best letters and interview the listeners in question over the phone. Their memories will enhance Radio Prague's special programming devoted to the 20th anniversary of the Velvet Revolution. Please send your letters to Vinohradská 12, postal code 12099, Prague, the Czech Republic, or you can email us at cr@radio.cz. And don't forget to include a phone number where you can be reached. Twenty years after, your memories on Radio Prague.
Now, in the last part of our show today here on Radio Prague, it's time for this week's Arts, for which I spoke to Simon Moore, who's just written a book based in the Czech Republic which has been subject to international acclaim. Czech architectural landmark has provided the backdrop and indeed central theme of a book which has been creating a stir in the literary world. The Glass Room by Simon Moore tells the story of a modernist villa in a Czech town, from conception to construction, eventually to seizure by the state. The Glass Room has been receiving a great deal of publicity ever since it was nominated for the prestigious Man Booker Prize. Over the phone from his home in Italy, author Simon Moore voiced his bewilderment as to why his book was proving so popular in Britain at the moment.
One of the characteristics of it is that it is completely not British. I mean, it's written in English, but the only British reference is the Neville Chamberlain at the Munich crisis coming over on the radio. So it's not in any way British. There's no setting in Britain. It doesn't have immediate and obvious appeal in that sense. It's about an aspect of sort of cultural and social life which I wouldn't have thought was instantly, you know, appealing to the British. I mean, Central Europe, the 1930s, 1940s in Central Europe, not really the sort of time that features much in British life. So it is interesting for me, that.
I wanted to ask you how this book was born. You've written a lot about the biologist Gregor Mendel, and I know that he lived in Brno, and so I figured that this book came out of the study you'd originally done about him and his life. Is that correct?
Yes, my initial visit, the very first time I ever visited the Czech Republic, was really as a sort of interested tourist. I knew of Mendel, and I'd always been quite intrigued by his story. That's, in my case, as the biologist talking, because I am a biologist. And so that visit sparked an interest in him. And of course, ultimately a novel, which is, I think, going to be actually published in Czech shortly, which is called Mendel's Dwarf. And having done that book, I was then commissioned by the Field Museum in Chicago, who put on a Mendel exhibition, and they commissioned me to write a companion volume to the exhibition. So that meant more visits to the area, and it was on one of those visits that I went to look at the Tugendhat House again. And it was really then when I thought to myself, there is a story here. My interest in things Czech had been growing over the previous, well, decade virtually, and the whole thing sort of came together in the Glass Room.
Now, I know that you have said in a foreword to the Glass Room that yes, there is a real building behind this book, and yes, there's a real town behind this book, but actually it won't shed too much light on your book if you look too much into the sort of biographical detail or the kind of historical detail. Nonetheless, can I ask a bit about how your research for, say, your biographical work on Gregor Mendel and then your research for this work of fiction, The Glass Room, differed?
Well, when I was doing the work for the Mendel book, in fact, too, because I've written a non-fiction one, the Field Museum one, of course, I was there interested in trying to get a feel for the real man. Mendel's Dwarf is a novel, and it has got Gregor Mendel's life in it, but I have taken liberties. And that's actually very important to me. I am not a biographer, and I wouldn't be happy with the restrictions that biography would place upon my writing. And of course, that meant absolutely that when I came to write the Glass Room, the Landauer family were not the Tugendhat family. And I obviously wanted the distance. What I wanted was to feel the house. I wanted to put myself imaginatively in the place of somebody who had it designed and built and lived in it. But I didn't want in any way to write a book about the Tugendhat family. Obviously, when you're writing that sort of novel, you can't fictionalize certain events and certain dates, and obviously both the fictional family and the real family fled the country in 1938, so there are little signposts like that, but the people themselves in the Glass Room are entirely my creation.
There's been a great deal of talk about the idea that a great deal of the books shortlisted for the Booker Prize this year were so-called historical novels. And you yourself have sort of said, actually, I don't necessarily want my novel to be seen as a historical novel in the past. Why is that? Why do you think that your novel shouldn't be termed straight out as a historical novel?
There is a completely different set of skills required and a completely different approach if you're trying to write something that takes place in the 16th century. My second novel was set in the 16th century. It's a 16th century historical novel. And I was very aware during the writing of that, so I've done it, is what I'm saying. I was very aware during the writing of that all the problems, the issues of how you make your characters sound. What do they say? What language do they use? You're trying to put yourself, and it's an almost impossible task, into the mind of people who are so distant for us that I suspect, talking rationally, you can almost say that the task is actually realistically impossible. It's a very different task to doing the same thing for the 1930s. My parents were brought up there. Their youth was in the 1930s. I spent a lot of time talking to my parents about their younger days. It's much, much closer. One knows what people sounded like and what their ideas were. So it's so much closer that I really think it's a different thing from a standard historical novel.
In both cases, in the case of your second novel and in the case of this, The Glass Room, you suggested you spent a great deal of time listening or trying to research the way that people would speak to each other. And this is something I wanted to ask you about, because you've been praised for your Czech language skills in the British media on several occasions. And from a read of your book, it does sound like you do have a command of Czech. Did you go out of your way to learn the Czech language in the run-up to writing this book? Or what's your relationship with the Czech language?
I look upon language as another thing to try and research, if you're going to use it in the book, in the narrative. I spent a lot of time with Czech English dictionary, going backwards and forwards, looking up a word in English to get the Czech, and then taking the Czech and going to the Czech side of the dictionary to see what other possible sort of, you know, meanings there could be, that sort of thing. And occasionally you light on something, and it's wonderful. The example that keeps coming to my mind is the use of the word pokoj for the room, which just provides that little sort of quirky thing that it's also peace and tranquility. And that's magical, because that isn't in the English.
Was author Simon Maurer speaking to me there from his home in Italy and bringing our programme here today on Radio Prague to a close. The Glass Room, his new book, is published by Little & Brown Publishers and available, of course, in all good bookshops. Remember that if you want to find the transcript of anything you've heard in today's show, then you can go and look at our website, which is www.radio.cz. And if you want to send us an email about anything you've heard, then the address for that is english@radio.cz. You can send us post, of course, to Vinohradská 12, 12099, Prague 2, the Czech Republic. But for now, from me, Rosie Johnston, and the rest of the team here in Prague, it's thanks for listening and goodbye.